Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest tonight got into the business of talent management on a whim. It was back in the late 60s, and Shep Gordon was selling marijuana out of the old Landmark Motor Hotel in Los Angeles. To keep away police suspicion, he dabbled in managing musicians, just in case anyone asked where he got the money. Shep Gordon is arguably one of the most successful managers in Hollywood history, whether it's musicians like Alice Cooper or Anne Murray or Teddy Pendergrass or actors like Groucho Marx or Raquel Welch. Gordon has been the man to help artists navigate their careers and handle fame. And some will say that Gordon's interest in food and managing Emeril Lagasse and Charlie Trotter created the world of the celebrity chef. So much in this book written, it's called They Call Me Supermensch, A Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll. Mike Myers directed a documentary of the same name as Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. And it is my pleasure to welcome the Supermensch, Shep Gordon, to The Download. Shep, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Hey, aloha. Welcome to Maui by phone.
We'll take it. I'm interested. There's a line in the book about, you talk a lot about your childhood, and you almost thank your childhood really because, you spent a lot of time alone thinking up the world around you and thinking up worlds. How did it help you to spend so much time alone?
I think, there's a part of what I do for a living with the artist, which was trying to see what the future brought, trying to get ahead of them and stop them from jumping in holes. And there was a second part of trying to see what the cultural waves of the time were, things like when video disc came out. And all that for me took time alone, thinking, creating a world in my brain that I could see if it worked or didn't work. I just found a path of creation that involved being alone, not being in groups. And I was very comfortable being alone as a kid. So I think it really helped me. I think it's one of the hard things for most people to do in life and work is create on their own. It's so easy to know you have a 9-to-5 job. You go in,
right?
You count it to, whatever you're doing and get done. But when you have to build the sandcastle, the time alone is really helpful for me.
In the book, you talk about this in a couple different places, about the idea of creating history, not waiting for it to happen. I mean, there's a lot of philosophy like this that really becomes sort of the threads and the through lines through your life.
For me, a lot of what I try to do, I call it catching a wave, which dovetails into creating history. So, for example, it was really easy for me to see that there was this wave in all culture, that things that older generations didn't like, younger generations went to. And that applied in music, and that was a lot of Alice's. Once I realized that was a universal, we were able to create history by doing things that we knew would upset parents, like throwing the chicken out.
Right.
And parents were writing the media. So I knew that I could get someone in the media angry who was a parent by doing something they didn't want their kids to participate in, which gave us space and helped us create history.
The book is great in the way that you have so much about your life representing different talent, but the bulk of it, at least the beginning part, is about your relationship with Alice Cooper. Talk about that relationship, because it started, like I said at the beginning, on a whim. some kids from Phoenix, but
I moved to L.A. I worked as a probation officer for a day, and it didn't work out. And I checked into a motel, and through a series of circumstances, ended up getting punched by Janis Joplin. And she introduced me to people who were living at the motel or hanging out there, and it was Jimi Hendrix and the Chambers Brothers and Jim Morrison and this rock and roll world. And I was, as Anthony Bourdain put it, a pharmaceutical salesman. And they were my perfect audience. So I started selling my drugs to them. And at one point, Jimi Hendrix said, what else do you do for a living? And I don't really do anything. I said, you need to have a legitimate story. If the police ask you where you got your money, you're Jewish, you should be a manager. So I said, great. Who do I manage? And Alice picks up the story with Jimi Hendrix and the Chambers Brothers walking in and saying, we found a Jew that'll manage you. So we started. Alice wasn't really at the top of his game at the time. It was a band. It was five guys named Alice Cooper, and they were sort of known in Hollywood for being able to get everybody to leave the concert hall, not come into it, which was sort of perfect for me because I was using it as a front for my drug dealing. So I didn't want to have to work too much. And then things became very hot in Hollywood in terms of arresting people. And Alice and I sat down and said, let's try and do this for real. And one of the things that we talked about was that his ability to get people to leave a room was something that played into this phenomenon of generational differences. So let's play that up. Let's not try and correct it. Let's try and be the most obnoxious thing we can possibly be.
Well, the theatrical components of the Alice Cooper show, I mean, were akin to a Broadway show. I mean, it was as Groucho Marx says in the book, you know, Alice is the last opportunity for vaudeville. I mean, talk about developing that show, developing Alice Cooper with the publicity techniques that you used, and also, you know, like you said, the idea of creating this world where parents are going to hate him. Talk about that. About the building of that brand.
We talked about how do we get to be successful, and music did not seem to be the driving force in the early days of the career. So we talked about where he really had his power was on stage and affecting people. It was a huge thing to get people to leave her when they were waiting to see the Doors. So what we decided to do was try and build a theatrical show that told the story and kept people in the room, use it as a strength. And in music, there were only good guys. There were no Captain Hooks. And we decided that we would create a character who was sort of the bad guy of rock and roll, Captain Hook, who would do these despicable things that parents would hate and kids would love it because the parent hated it. So we used things like snakes on stage, guillotines. As the show developed, we then found Bob Ezrin, who had worked for a company that did the Guess Who records. And he came in and really brought the music up to where it needed to be. The message of the music was always great. It was the actual form in which the music appeared. And he taught the guys how to make a record and say what they wanted to say in a record that was accessible on radio. And that's when it all came together. And since we had started doing shows, we used the money from the records to do sort of a traveling Broadway show that told the story of this despicable character, Alice, who would do these horrible things. He'd chop up baby dolls. He'd spit on people. And then he would get killed by the townspeople for these despicable acts. He'd get guillotined or hung or electrocuted. And then he would come back in white, reborn as a hero.
It's such an interesting journey of the publicity techniques and things you did to reinforce the idea of creating this villain in rock and roll, Alice Cooper. Shep Gordon's my guest. He's a great historic Hollywood talent agent manager. He's the author of They Call Me Supermensch's memoir, A Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll. We'll take a quick break here on The Download, and we'll come back with more with Shep Gordon. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest on the line from Maui is Shep Gordon. He's the author of They Call Me Supermensch, The Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll. He has managed everyone from Alice Cooper to Teddy Pendergrass to Luther Vandross to Groucho Marx. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. As we pick back up the story about Alice Cooper, as that's happening, as Alice Cooper gets the music in line with the show and you're touring around, he goes to number one, schools out. I mean, you have a career on your hands in the sense that now... you've got one of the biggest stars in music, if not just music in general at that time.
The last thing we expected, by the way.
Yeah, right. What's going through your mind at this point? I mean, are you saying, okay, this is now what I'm going to do. I'm going to take on other clients. I'm going to do other things. What was going through your mind when you sort of had this meteoric rise to the top?
You know, it was happening so fast, it was hard to really deal with it or contemplate it. But I started to get other acts asking me to manage them, and I didn't really know if I was any good or not. You know, I didn't know if this was a complete fluke, and we just got lucky and along for the ride, or did I actually affect the success we had. And I didn't really want to do it if I wasn't good at it, because what I realized really early on is you had someone's life in your hand for what I did. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I could move on to the next act if it didn't work. Alice was going to be Alice, whether it worked or not worked. And that's a heavy responsibility. And very few people have 100% batting averages in any business they're in. So that weighed on me. So I decided I would take as my second act, I was being offered just about everybody because I was this young freak and I didn't sign contracts. And Alice was so out of left field and became the biggest touring act of 72. So a lot of that success bled off to me. So I decided I'd take the furthest thing. And it was a girl named Ann Murray came to me. And she was as far away from Alice as I could get. So I started working with her. And I took a couple of icons who had other lives, Groucho Marx and Raquel Welch. And I figured between those three, I could really get a sense of Did I know what I was doing? Was it all luck? Could I really help these people?
Well, with Anne Murray came the idea of the guilt by association, which is a technique that you use throughout your career. This concept of really starting to, you know, build up celebrity by using celebrities around you.
In her case, it came at a time when I love doing ironic things because they always go under attention. So I booked her into the Troubadour on Thanksgiving, knowing she was Canadian, just for the irony of it. And I built this big bronze and wood turkey that was the backdrop, and 12 violin players got into the feathers where the feathers were in the turkey. And I figured this is about as ironic as it's ever going to get in life. But I knew that being in Hollywood, I would have an opportunity maybe to get somebody famous with her. But you book a show a long time ahead of time. But it just so happened that week, Alice had a drinking group called the Hollywood Vampires that met at the Rainbow Bar and Grill. And I was their designated driver. There was no Uber. There was none of that. Nobody had money for taxis. You know, this was a different time. So, and that week, John Lennon showed up. It was during his dark era, and everybody wanted a picture of John Lennon. So I went to the Rainbow, and John was there with Harry Nilsson and Mickey Dolenz, who was from the Monkees, who were gigantic then. And I went to him, and I sort of got down on my hands and knees, and I said, listen, I got this girl, Anne Murray. You don't have to stay for the show. You don't have to watch anything. But if I can get you there for a picture, I think I can really make her career. And if you don't go for the picture, you better find a new driver.
There you go.
So they all came walking. They were probably there 30 seconds in the room, but we got a picture.
That's all that counts.
And that picture exploded. Her midnight special went from not willing to book her to having her host it. Rolling Stone, this was all within a week. Rolling Stone went from not wanting to do a story on her to doing a big feature. It happened so fast that she went from boring Canadian to most exciting thing on the horizon. Just from that picture with John Lennon.
That's amazing. Chef Gordon, my guest, he's a longtime talent agent. His memoir, They Call Me Supermensch, A Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll, out now. Also, the documentary that Mike Myers directed is also on Netflix. What I really like, and the connection to Chicago, you know, you talk in the title, of course, Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll. Food plays a big part. I mean, not just in your life as someone who cooks and can serve food to the Dalai Lama, but as somebody who has represented chefs and created this celebrity chef culture. Talk about that, because you represented a young Charlie Trotter here in Chicago before the idea of knowing who the chefs were.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just talking about Charlie yesterday with a couple other chefs who were here on the island. To me, that's a perfect example of what I was talking about before, of catching a wave and putting some faces on it and creating history. The demand for Charlie Trotter's restaurant in Chicago was unparalleled in the world of events. And what I mean by that is, if you had enough money, you could be on the 50-yard. You could wake up in the morning and say, I want to be on the 50-yard line at the Super Bowl. You could buy the ticket. Mm-hmm. You could wake up in the morning and say, I want to be in the front row of a Broadway play and get the ticket. You could wake up in the morning and say, I want to eat at Charlie Trotter's, and you probably could get a reservation 7 months later.
Right.
I actually was negotiating a lease with another Chicago company, General Growth, and they were the biggest owners of shopping malls in America.
The building right on the river, right.
And I was negotiating for a restaurant in Honolulu, Don Ho's Island Grill. And when the person in Honolulu found out that I represented Charlie Trotter, they gave me he said if I could get their chairman, who had been trying for 5 months to get into Charlie Trotter, if I could get him in, they would give me a much softer deal on the rent. And they did, and I got him in.
It's not like it is now, where people are trying to, that the chefs are celebrities, that they're millionaires, they're the face of the franchise. I mean, there's stories in the book about some of the chefs you worked with that they wouldn't let in the restaurants because they were considered, quote-unquote, help. I mean, it was a whole different time.
Charlie Trotter. He was treated horribly. If Charlie, in the year that I met him, made $50,000, $60,000 in the restaurant, that would be gigantic. So it was so obvious to me that the demand was there, that there was this amazing demand. You looked at Spago, you couldn't get into. You look at Le Cirque, you couldn't get into. But no one had monetized it. And it's impossible to monetize stuff till you put a face on it.
Right.
So for me, that was the easiest thing I ever did, because the demand was there. So my job was to build highways to their audience. I used to tell them that Michael Jackson would be a wandering minstrel if there weren't radio stations, record pressing plants, MTV. If he couldn't reach his audience through media, he'd be a wandering minstrel.
Yeah.
And that's what they were. The only way you could touch Charlie Trotter was in his 60-seat restaurant in Chicago. So, you know, I did things like get the Food Network on the air, got Charlie Trotter pots and pans in stores or Emerald Spices, or started to allow the people who wanted to touch him to touch him.
Outside of the building, outside of the brick and mortar of their restaurant. That's the key.
Outside of the brick and mortar, just like musical art. And in many ways, exactly like the artist I was managing. Alice has to do his hits. Charlie Trotter had to do his great recipes. Alice has to create new songs. Charlie had to create new recipes. Alice wears his dungarees and goes to the mall in the afternoon, changes into his makeup for the show. Charlie goes to the mall in his dungarees, puts on his whites for the evening show. Alice will be backstage, you know, telling the band, listen, last night I didn't like the guitar break on this. Can you do this on this? Charlie's got his staff in the kitchen saying, the chicken was too salty last night. Let's readjust. And then Alice walks on stage with a big smile and does his show. And Charlie comes out of the kitchen with a smile and greets people in the restaurant. It's really the same thing.
It's an amazing life. I mean, for you to have, you know, created history and represented all this talent, you know, the things that you talk about in the book as well, is just, you know, there's a balancing act when it comes to the managing creative talent. And a lot of that, I think at some point you said, you know, if I represent you and it goes successful, you know, you might die in the way that there's a rock and roll lifestyle that's attached to this stuff. I mean, talk about
that.
Talk about the world around it, because it's not just about, you know, attaining or creating history and attaining all the fame and riches. There's an underbelly to this.
Yeah, no, I think it's very tough. On so many levels, it's difficult. I think, you know, I think every human being has self-worth issues. I've never met anyone, when you really get honest and dig deep enough, who doesn't have some kind of self-worth issues. And to have everybody telling you you're great all the time for reasons maybe you don't understand, that's a difficult thing to internalize and be happy with. In terms of live artists, which is what I mostly dealt with, you know, and I consider the chefs live artists the same way as entertainers, because they have, they're looking for people to tell them every night how great they are. And they work unbelievably hard to get people, you know, someone like an Alice in a way is a junkie for that applause every night. And to work so hard to get people to say you're great usually means your self-worth issues are bigger than the guy standing next to you, which drives you on more for this false kind of endorsement from people who don't actually know you. And when you get it, you still have the same self-worth issues. You're still the same person. Doesn't matter if 100,000 people a night are clapping. You may think that's going to cure your self-worth stuff, but it doesn't. And those are dangerous ones. You know, people turn to hard drugs, liquor. You look at my group of people from when I started. Janis Joplin died, Jimi Hendrix died, Jim Morrison died. They all died at 27 as their careers were flying high. You know, it's not just coincidence. So, you know, I used to warn all my clients. I would say, if I do my job perfect, I might kill you. But I'm not perfect, but I will maim you. I'm good enough that you will get maimed. And even in my group, you know, Alice is in rehab twice. Teddy Pendergrass, quadriplegic. Luther, gone. Blondie, rehab. You look even in my small group of artists who I tried to nurture and was really aware of it, and I couldn't save a lot of them.
You approach this business, and this business is well known, maybe in a stereotypical way, to the outsider, the quote-unquote swimming with sharks. A very aggressive, we see the stereotypes play out on shows like Entourage and other, where agents and managers are cutthroat and they want to win at all costs for their clients. And it's just what we know about Hollywood. But you've created a different persona, and a persona that obviously gives you the title Supermensch, which is great. But, you know, a sort of win-win, but also a real focus on gratitude and a focus on doing the right things. Is that the right way for me to categorize it, you versus the way that Hollywood has always been depicted?
Yeah, I think you put it perfectly in saying the way Hollywood has been depicted. I don't think it's as bad as it's been depicted. I have very few people in my 50 years that I can say went out of their way to hurt me or one of my artists. There are some, but I think for the most part, if they're given a choice of a win-win or a win-lose, they will tend to go for the win-win. It's most of the time people don't understand you can do it. I think there's a perception that you have to have a loser, but I think if you spend the time, I have found explaining how you can do a win-win and working the extra effort. Most people are happier doing that.
Gratitude plays a big part in your life, too. Gratitude. I mean, you end a lot with thank you. I mean, you seem to find a very philosophical center for this kind of work.
I think I say it in the book near the end. Just where you drop out of the womb, you sort of win or lose the game. And I dropped out in America. So I am so thankful every day. I know that if I had been born in Southern Africa, the possibility of my attaining what I've attained is almost non-existent, most places in South America or most places in Asia. So I am so consciously aware of how lucky and blessed my life has been that I say thank you every day and get my kids doing it.
Well, thank you for the interview. Shep Gordon is the author
Thank you. Congratulations on baseball. Wow.
Yeah, right?
What
That's
a year.
Right. That's the Cubs convention is coming up here, so it'll be an interesting one. This is the first win in, I think, Cub convention history. The author of They Call Me Supermensch, The Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll, Shep Gordon, longtime Hollywood music manager and agent. A documentary is also, you can see, Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon on Netflix, directed by Mike Myers. Thanks so much for taking some time out. We really appreciate it, Mr. Gordon. Thanks.
Thank you. Aloha.